What political party first proposed the income tax, backed civil rights for African Americans, encouraged immigration and government land giveaways, pushed for a large activist federal government, promoted regulation of business and industry, pushed for massive federal expenditures on infrastructure and education? Our next guest on Midday says it's the same party that just took over Congress by promising to do none of the above and to undo many of the same initiatives it undertook in its early years. How did the Republican Party move so far away from the principles of Abraham Lincoln? Historian Heather Cox Richardson with an ideological history of the GOP. Next on Midday, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Thanks again for joining us. Dan Rodericks here. When the Republican Party won the Senate this fall, and with it a bigger majority in Congress than it's had since 1928, it also marked a near reversal of the principles that guided its founding members nearly 170 years ago. Our next guest on Midday is historian Heather Cox Richardson. She traces those changes in a new history of the GOP, describing a party that has swung from left to right repeatedly over the decades, so much that the stars of the party 60 years ago would be viewed probably as liberal big government pariahs today. How did the party of Abraham Lincoln come to attack the Voting Rights Act at the state level and work to reduce minority participation through restrictive voter ID laws? How did the GOP morph from a party that promoted an activist government, that favored immigration, that wanted to regulate the excesses of big business, invented the income tax, gave free land to the poor, invested billions in roads, schools, and other projects? How did that morph into the party that says no to virtually all of the above, a party that critics say now favors the rich at the expense of the working and middle class? Heather Cox Richardson, a professor of history at Boston College, argues that the Republican Party has always had these contradictions at its core as a result of the founding tension between the belief in equality of opportunity and the protection of property. We're going to talk about that in this hour with Heather Richardson. The party emerged in reaction to the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which overturned the Missouri Compromise and threatened to spread slavery into a West that it wanted to be open to, quote, poor but hardworking, ambitious young men. Although unrelated to Thomas Jefferson's Republican Party, Heather Richardson says the GOP adopted its name and the first principles of Republican government, which included an end to the concentration of wealth among the upper few percent. Heather Richardson says there are lessons to be learned from three presidents who, she argues, were true to the original Republican cause: Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower. There are equally important, if darker, lessons from the reactionary periods that followed them as the party swerved back to pro-business policies and legislation that resulted in three economic crashes, 1893, 1929, and 2008. Although Republicans are on a roll now, which may be due to an unpopular president or an uncertain Democratic leadership, as much to that as it does to the Republican message that we heard going into the fall election, there's a question of how long the Republican ascendance can last as the base of older white men dies off, replaced by a younger, more diverse, and more Democratic electorate. We'll ask Heather Cox Richardson about all of this and more in this hour as she discusses her new history of the Republican Party entitled To Make Men Free, published by Basic Books. Heather Richardson, nice to have you on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is really interesting stuff because I'm sure a lot of people in our audience wonder, is this the Republican Party? Was Lincoln's party? You know, you come across that in the history lesson, and it makes no sense to a lot of people who see today's Republican Party. I want to go to that central tension you talk about in the book, that contradiction. And let's start there. This idea of equality of opportunity on one hand and the protection of property on the other. This is sort of this founding tension you talk about in the book.
Yeah, that tension actually comes right from the very start of America. And so it's a tension in the Republican Party, but it is ultimately a tension in America. And that is that the Declaration of Independence promised equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome, but equality of opportunity to every, and of course, man at this era is what they're talking about, but the equality of opportunity to every man. And that's a declaration of principle behind which young men were willing to rally to fight the American Revolution. When the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, though, they had a very different set of concerns, and that was they were worried about the establishment of a nation and the protection of property for the people who lived within that nation. So the Declaration of Principle in the Declaration of Independence that calls for equality of opportunity is very different than the protection of property that's promised in the Constitution. At first, the Founding Fathers don't see that there's going to be a problem with these two things because it seems like America has such great resources that there's no tension, that basically there's always going to be enough for everybody, that nobody's going to monopolize anything. But very quickly, almost immediately after the Revolution, it becomes clear as people move west into Kentucky, actually, that very wealthy people will take over the government. They will get more than other people. They will start to use their influence to influence judges and to influence elections. They will take over the government. And once they take over the government, they will pass legislation that makes it impossible for poorer men to have access to resources. And democracy, the very idea on which America was founded, will fall apart because the country will come to be run by a very few people. So that tension is clear by the 1790s, and that continues to play out through American history to the present.
Let's talk about then the birth of the Republican Party, not the Jefferson Republicans, but the Lincoln Republicans. And this bit of history is really interesting. I mentioned the Missouri Compromise and how that plays in it. So take a couple of minutes here and tell us about the birth of the party.
Well, you know, it's so funny when you listen to all the things you talked about in that introduction, it sounds like it's all of American history sort of jumbled together. But if you pull it apart and lengthen it out as it happened, the trajectory is actually obvious and very interesting. And that is that after the Revolution, of course, Americans begin to pour west with this idea that there's going to be all this free land and there's going to be enough for everybody. And one of the families that does this is Abraham Lincoln's family. And Lincoln is one of those people, and his family are the people who believe they can rise when they move west. And they move first to Kentucky. And Kentucky is the area where wealthy men come and take it over. And one of the things that those wealthy men, those slaveholders, do is they make it impossible for younger, less wealthy men like Lincoln's father to rise. So he jumps ship and crosses over the Ohio River into the old Northwest that has been protected from slavery and from slaveholders by the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And that tension right there, the idea that you can't have slavery, you can't have wealthy men around because they're going to take over the government, is very ingrained even in Lincoln's DNA, if you will. But again, there's plenty of Western land. It doesn't seem like it's going to be a huge deal. Well, what happens in 1854 is with the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the slave owners who control at that point Congress, the White House, and the Supreme Court overturn the Missouri Compromise, which says that the West will be kept open, the Northwest will be kept open for men without slavery to go and farm and to mine and to hunt and to be able to rise. With the overturning of the Missouri Compromise in 1854, Lincoln and men like him in the North become terrified that, in fact, slave owners are going to take over the national government, not just state governments as they did in the South, but the national government. And with that, the Republican Party is born with the principle that the government must not come to be beholden to a few wealthy men. The slaveholders who are controlling the government at that point are only about 1% of the population, and they don't want that. So that the link to the early founding fathers and the idea of democracy, meaning that the government should be there to enable every man to have equal access to resources and to rise. There's a direct trajectory from the Founding Fathers through this move west that the Lincolns do into the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the establishment of the Republican Party by 1856. And then, of course, Lincoln is elected president in 1860 at the head of a brand new fledgling party that's going to have to create itself during the Civil War.
And that party, so that founding belief is widespread opportunity. Would you say that's accurate?
Of the Republican Party?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That the government should be involved in promoting widespread economic opportunity.
Well, at first, it's only that the government should not be beholden to the very wealthy,
right,
who are stamping out equal opportunity. But
got
during
that.
During the war itself, the party is going, in order to fight the war, which is going to cost over $2.5 billion and involve more than a million men in the armies and in the navies, the government is going to have to change dramatically. And in the process of doing that, of raising those armies, one of the first things it has to do is it has to create taxes. So it creates our first national taxes, including the income tax. But then it also wants to enable more and more people to pay those taxes and more people to become to rise. And so it passes the Homestead Act in 1862 to put men on farms. It passes the Land-Grant College Act that same year, which gives us our national university system. Except for the University of North Carolina, if anybody cares. That's the one that was actually established before that. Somebody always calls that out. It establishes our first national money and banking system by cutting wealthy financiers out of the system and resting the government's willingness to pay and ability to pay on the backs of regular workers and putting money and bonds based on that rather than on capital. It promotes the Union Pacific Railroad to get men out to the mines and to the farms. And finally, and most dramatically, in 1865, it declares that America will not have castes of people. Everybody will be free in America. African Americans, of course, in the 13th Amendment, but also by implication, the Chinese who are falling under certain state laws in California that set them off as different people. Pacific Islanders that people are very worried about in the 1860s, and ultimately even large numbers of Indians who will be included in this new idea that everybody should be helped by the government to enable them to rise to competence.
Heather Richardson is our guest in this hour of midday. Her book is To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. So would you say that in examining the history of the party from the time of Lincoln till today, it's not so much an arc as it is peaks and valleys, ups and downs, bouncing along left and right or up and down?
A pendulum swing or a cycle, yes. Not necessarily highs and lows. It depends on how you look at things.
Well, tell us about that, because there are these periods when what you just described occurs in the party, that seems to become central to the party's part of the party's core. You see it during Teddy Roosevelt's period, a period of progressivism following the Gilded Age. And then after that, we go into the period of Hoover and Coolidge and then the Great Depression. So I guess that's what I mean by the way the party sort of swings. I guess you're right, using the pendulum, swings left to right, more government, more activism versus those who say, no, this is socialism. You can't have this.
Yeah, and this is a pattern that's laid down during the Civil War and in Reconstruction immediately after the Civil War. And the crucial link here is that during the Civil War, as the government is doing all these things to help regular guys, if you will, it also passes those first national taxes, including the income tax. So a number of people who don't believe they need help by the government immediately after the Civil War, immediately after Teddy Roosevelt, immediately after Eisenhower's expansion of the government, start to argue that any kind of government activism is socialism or communism. And that actually comes out of the 1870s when the Paris Commune from March through May of 1871, workers take over Paris and they run Paris as a commune. As far as Americans are concerned, this is workers redistributing wealth. They're passing legislation that moves wealth from the pockets of the very wealthy down into the workers. Back in America, this becomes just a terrible fear that if you let African Americans and workers vote, which they're doing by 1871, what they're going to do is take control of the government and use it to pass legislation that is going to cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars are going to come from wealthier people. Therefore, it is a redistribution of wealth. And Americans become extremely concerned about communism and socialism in 1871, not after the Bolshevik Revolution. That's the second wave. So you get first an activist government, then this sort of a racist and xenophobic fear that if you let black people and workers vote, they're going to redistribute wealth. And they play very heavily both on hatred of immigrants and hatred of African Americans in that phase. Then the party quite deliberately ties itself to big business with the idea that what the government really is supposed to do is protect property. When it does that in the 1880s, the 1920s, and the 1990s and 2000-aughts, wealth stratifies dramatically. It begins to move up, redistribute upward rather than downward. When that happens, at every point, we've had a major depression, 93, the Great Crash, in 2008. And then when that happens, the party has to regroup, has to reinvent itself, and it reinvents itself as a party that uses the government to help the guy on the street. It's been a pattern since the party formed in 1854.
Heather, this is really interesting. We'll come back and talk some more, all right? A short break here. Heather Cox Richardson, a Boston College historian, professor there, author of this new and provocative history of the Republican Party called To Make Men Free, available from Basic Books. Now, if you have a question for our guest, please give us a ring. This is how you reach us on Midday. Locally, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. And the email address from Midday, you can address a question that way, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Some American history for you in this hour of the show. To Make Men Free is Heather Cox Richardson's book, A History of the Republican Party. And Heather, I just want to share a couple of things with you. Comments from our listeners on Facebook regarding your show today on the Party of Lincoln, writes Dan, one of our listeners. Here's what today's typical GOPer would have said about the Emancipation Proclamation. Quote, I realize slavery is a bad thing, but why does our president always have to make everything be about race? Besides, it's not the government's role to decide what slave owners should do about their own property. Yet another example of the nanny state. And then Bruce adds to this that you forgot to mention the other part of the response. The Emancipation Proclamation is an overreaching executive order issued by a despotic imperial president who is violating the Constitution. Lincoln should be impeached. But I thought you would find those amusing. But, you know, if you go back to Lincoln's time, those who were calling for his impeachment were not members of his own party.
What's fun about that, those comments, is that they've nailed it. This is a pattern of language and a pendulum swing, if you will, that in fact was laid down during the Civil War and Reconstruction, and they have exactly nailed what the language is like. And it actually comes out of a principled place, if you will. I think it's very easy to just sort of throw up your hands and say, oh, those people are racists. And they say, oh, no, we're not. Mm. And then you're stuck. In fact, the argument went from the slaveholders that they were the ones who truly understood how to run an economy. They were the ones who, first of all, had all the money. So they must be doing something right. And God probably favored them. They were the ones with the brains. They were the ones who really cared about education and about moving society forward and increasing productivity. And the vast majority of people were kind of dull. You know, they just wanted to drink and to party, and they really didn't care a lot about moving anything forward. And what you really wanted to make sure of was that those people never got too much power, because if they did, they would simply want to take the wealth and the power from the good guys at the top of the chain and take it for themselves, and they would just waste it. And society would fall apart, that in fact things would stop moving, the economy would stop growing, and that really what you wanted to do was have a society where the very best men were on top of the people they called the mudsills. And they actually called them that. Those were the pieces of a house that got slammed into the mud so that there could be a superstructure on top of that. And that idea that the wealthy should run things was actually seen as a principled plan. And if you think about, for example, that's how the slave owners talked. And Lincoln said, oh, no, wait a minute here. I was one of those mudsills. I'm smart. I want to move society forward. That's not the way America should be. So people side with Lincoln. But by the 1880s and the 1890s, you got people like Andrew Carnegie, who's not calling for slavery. I don't want to say that. But he does articulate a world where, again, the very wealthy are the ones who manage their money right. They endow opera houses and colleges and labs, and they're the ones who really will make society move forward. And that idea that the wealthy really should control society for the good of everyone is an idea that's very much in tension with what people like Lincoln or people like Roosevelt, who was himself wealthy, or people like Eisenhower believed.
This is really interesting. The word mudsill, actually, I went to look it up, and it is exactly as you say. It's the foundational part of a house. It's right in the mud. But it also means slaves and drudges put on earth to support the wealthy, right? Isn't that not what it means in the metaphorical term? And I'm speaking here of the man you quote in the book, James Henry Hammond, who was a Democrat at the time.
That's correct, yes. It comes from a speech that we all know as the Cotton is King speech. But actually what that speech was primarily about was the mudsills. It was also known at the time as the mudsill speech, in which he outlined this vision of the world, that the wealthy should run things because they were the ones God had favored. They were the ones who truly understood human beings. And that stood very much in contrast to what Lincoln articulated in response to him the next year in 1859, in which he said, No, America is about free labor. It's about everybody having the right to the fruits of his own labor and being able to make enough money that he can support a family. And because God is good, he's created a world where people will be able to produce more than they need, so they will accumulate capital, which actually Lincoln called pre-exerted labor, as many political economists did at the time. They'll be able to accumulate capital and hire other people. And that's the way a good society should work. So this war is not just about slavery or about whether the union should exist. It's actually a fight about what the government should be and what the government should do. And that's a tension that I think we still argue about today.
That James Henry Hammond I mentioned was a slave-owning senator from South Carolina. And the speech you mentioned, again, 1858. Heather, where did the idea of a smaller government come from? We hear so much today about the politics of austerity. The federal government is a monster. It's too big. It needs to be reined in. We hear a lot of that. That's part of the Republican rhetoric for a long time now, and more intense in the last few years. Do we hear that in the 19th century and the 20th century?
Absolutely. It comes, although it's very different right now. I don't want to suggest it's all the same thing, but the roots of it lay in the years before the Civil War, when slave owners did not want to have any kind of an active government because they believed that if you had an active government, it would, and it started to do things like develop roads to the West, which was very popular, that once it started messing around in the economy, it was only a question of time until it started messing around with slavery. So they're adamant that the government must do absolutely nothing. And in fact, James Henry Hammond in that same speech says, listen, even if the vast majority of Americans want the government to do something, even if everybody wants them to do something, the Constitution guarantees that the government can never do anything because the founding fathers, he says in this speech, knew that the democracy could descend into a mob. So they tried to protect property from a mob. And the Constitution guarantees the protection of property. And that means no taxes and no government. So he says that back then, and that, of course, comes up every time the government becomes active. One of the things it does is it needs money to pay for that government. Now, in the 19th century, it pays for it primarily by tariffs. But again, that rhetoric of this is your tax dollars that are, say, supporting troops in the South to protect African Americans, or employing workers to build roads in New York City, that rhetoric becomes very popular, even though by our standards, those governments are very small. Now, that being said, if you want to fast forward to the present, because while the 19th century is the roots of this, all of this, most people are probably interested more recently, the fight against what is considered a behemoth government now is an absolutely fascinating one and slightly different than it has been before, because while the rhetoric is the same and the words are the same, the difference is that We are now, I mean, everybody thinks the present Republican Party dates from Ronald Reagan. In fact, he's a halfway point now. The modern day roots of the modern day Republican Party lie in the New Deal. And during the 1930s, when the Democrats under FDR created a huge range of programs that help to supply a safety net to make sure that the Great Depression never happens again. And one of the pieces of the New Deal was the protection of labor, was giving labor bargaining power. And this, to hardcore Republicans, the people that became, you know, trajectory-wise, are probably today's Tea Partiers, this was anathema to them, and not necessarily just to Republicans, but also to fledgling libertarians at the time, who were very wealthy and who backed the idea that any kind of government activism was communism, because that would support, because it supported workers, it gave workers bargaining power. And that idea that somehow in the modern era the government doing anything is communism, that the government must do nothing but promote business and supply a big military, which of course also promotes business, and that anything else is communism, and you cannot compromise on anything because anything beside that is communism. That actually is the product of the New Deal, which is, again, the efforts of the Republican Party now to insist that taxes are a terrible problem and the huge government is a terrible problem and all those things. That comes in a fight against a very specific fight against the New Deal. It's worth remembering that people like Eisenhower, the top income bracket under Eisenhower, the top income tax bracket, paid a 91% tax rate. That's a Republican coming out of this era. So that's a very different sort of fight than started way back with the slave owners.
Heather Richardson is our guest, a historian at Boston College. Her book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Heather, I'm going to take some questions. Questions, please, from our listeners here. I'm going to step away for a moment while we get a couple of questions in from folks who listen to WYPR. 410-662-8780 is our number. This is Jeff in Lutherville. Jeff, go right ahead with your question for Heather.
Yes, it's maybe a bit off tangent, but I mean, I think it's still relevant. I just wondered what her opinion was of the creation of the IRS by the rich conservatives such as Rockefeller, Ford, and so on. And I mean, basically, it's an illegal. I mean, it's.
You have a your question is, what did she think of the fact that those gentlemen were involved in supporting the establishment of Internal Revenue Service? Okay. Heather?
Well, actually, the IRS begins in 1862. It doesn't begin in the modern era. And the idea behind it, when they created the IRS, the question was, how were you going to raise taxes? And in fact, there was a big fight within the party in which people said, you know, we have to keep collecting at the state level, which is how taxes had been handled before that. There's a long history to that, but take my word for it, that's right. And what happened in Congress is they discussed at great length the fact it would be far cheaper simply to set up a system through the federal government because they had to collect taxes somehow, but also that it was a good thing for people to pay taxes to their government. And the reason for that is because it would create a loyalty to that government. And in fact, it worked. By 1864, 1865, all Americans, and those are people who were fighting for the North, of course, all Americans felt a loyalty to their government. And crucially, they had a stake in it surviving. And its very life was on the chopping block right then. So the system worked, but it's not a 20th century phenomenon. That's straight out of 1862 is where that law comes from and that establishment comes from.
Interesting period that you cover in your book is Reconstruction. What happened to the party of Lincoln after Lincoln's death? William in Baltimore has a question about that period of time. William, welcome to Midday.
Hello. My question is that considering how much corruption started, especially after Andrew Johnson had come into power, like with the whiskey ring scandal, 110 people were indicted that worked for the Revenue Department. And with all these different scandals, how did the Republican Party still stayed in power and then grew from that?
Yeah, let's talk about the Reconstruction period. Actually, William was wondering also, he told our screener, you know, how could they claim to be working for the working people when they seemed to be more interested in moneyed interests, and really in Johnson's period didn't support the mission of Reconstruction. So, Heather, from you, please.
Well, William, you're a man after my own heart, because Reconstruction is I think, the most interesting period in American history. And I didn't like it when my first book was actually on the Civil War. I tumbled into Reconstruction by accident. You've pinpointed a central moment in the party, and that is that Andrew Johnson is his own topic, which we could talk about. But what's more interesting to from your question is the question of corruption. And one of the things that happens is, let's forget Andrew Johnson for now, but because he's not really a Republican. But what happens is, after Grant is elected in 68, Grant is a brilliant man. He really is. I could just go on forever about Grant. But he's a backwoods hick, if you will. And the person who thinks he should be in charge of the Republican Party is Charles Sumner, who is the leading senator, a leading senator, and is the guy who got beaten almost to death in 1856 for supporting the Republican Party. And that's a long story, too. Mm-hmm. But in any case, he thought he should be the head of the Republican Party. He's smart. He's wealthy. He's everything you can imagine. And he starts a fight with Grant. When he does that, he is actually very close to Horace Greeley, who is sort of the dean of newspaper men in the North in America. So what happens is, when Sumner tries to take over the party and he gets the newspaper men behind him, they have to have some way to weaken Grant, who is, in fact, very popular. And what they do is they decide that they are going to pick up the language of the Democrats and say that what Grant is really trying to do is to create a government that is growing every day. It's getting bigger and bigger. And what it's really trying to do is to keep Republicans in office, because this is an era of patronage. So if you have a government job, you belong to the party in power. We don't have civil service reform yet. And that as this government gets bigger and bigger, it's going to be, again, supporting itself by taxes levied on hardworking Americans, primarily in this case Democrats. So they go after Grant with the idea that he is corrupt, and they try and pin everything under the sun on him. Now, the whiskey scandal is actually true. That does happen. And there's a wonderful book called, 10 Years with the Whiskey Ring, or My Time in the Federal Penitentiary, which I think is one of the greatest titles of all time, by a guy whose last name is Richardson, believe it or not, but we're not related, I hope. Or maybe it's McDonald, actually.
Okay.
But that's actually true. But the whole idea of Grant being corrupt is, in fact, a product of Sumner and Greeley and all of these Republican newspaper editors who jump on board to try and wrest the party away from Grant in 1872. And so this whole idea of Grant as being unusually corrupt is not true. Now, that being said, Grant turns against these guys who are viciously attacking him, of course. And where is he going to go? He's going to go to try and get control of New York, where there are 35 electoral votes up for grabs. So who's he going to go to? He's going to go to the guy who controls Wall Street. And 1872 is a fascinating year, because that's the year that Wall Street goes from supporting the Democrats, which they always had before, to supporting the Republicans. Hmm. And when that happens, the party ties itself to big business. And they actually have this big rally of financiers and industrialists on Wall Street to support Grant, to come out for him, and to try and make sure he gets the electoral votes from New York in 1872. That's the moment that the party becomes about big business, in 1872. So there's both the corruption issue and the big business issue. And by 1872, as you go forward, there's a fight in the party between sort of the old-fashioned reformer Lincoln Republicans like Hayes and Garfield, who, of course, Garfield's assassinated. That's the end of that story. And the party by 1885, 1886, 1884 even, when they lose to Cleveland, is tied to big business because of that initial fight between Sumner and Grant.
Heather, we'll take another break here. Heather Cox Richardson giving us her history of the Republican Party, now published in her book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party from Basic Books. A short break on Midday. If you have a question for our guest, 410-662-8780. We're going to jump into the 20th century and the 21st century and the Republican Party. And we'll talk about today's Republican Party after this short break on Midday. The Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, promoted an activist government, established an income tax, regulated big business, spent billions on roads, education, and other public infrastructure. Today, a party that sees government as an enemy, favors deregulation of just about everything, and has become the favorite of the wealthy and the corporate interests who have benefited from its policies. Heather Cox Richardson, our guest in this hour of the show, with a history of the Republican Party called To Make Men Free. And that's a very interesting connection you make to Wall Street for us during the time of U.S. Grant, 1872. Push things up now to 2007, 2008, and the economic collapse, the economic debacle of 2007, 2008. You'd think that after that, Heather, that the party's connection to Wall Street, its support of Wall Street, would have been completely discredited. And yet, you know, 6 years later, it seems to be roaring back. But you see that as part of the pattern of Republican rule in this country.
I do. And you know, the present always changes the past in a way, the way you look at it. But one of the things that people have asked me a lot about recently is, you know, what's going forward? What can we see going forward? And I actually think the patterns of the moment, not even what I would have said a year ago, but the patterns of the moment look very much like the 1880s and the 1890s, when the ideology of the Republican Party, if you will, the very pro-business, I mean exceedingly pro-business view of the Republican Party, is no longer that popular. They're still winning elections, but they're winning elections by gerrymandering, by voter suppression, by all the same techniques they used in the 1880s and the 1890s. And the desperate problem with that, again, you talk about the sweep we've just been through. If you look at the policies that are passing, they tend to be Democratic policies or progressive policies, if you will, although the Republicans continue to be holding more and more power. The problem with that is that the same thing that happened in the 1880s and the 1890s is because the echo chamber is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and fewer people are actually controlling the party and therefore controlling the government. That once that cracks open, and the Republican ideology no longer appeals even to half of the people in that echo chamber. Once that cracks open, they will reopen the vote and change the gerrymandered districts and reopen the floodgates, if you will, to the people who don't approve of this. And the backlash, once again, will be extreme. I think we're looking at another progressive era myself.
I want to read something to you that Garrison Keillor wrote a few years ago during the height of the financial meltdown. And he wondered where the crepe-soled common sense Republicans were, you know, the bankers, the conservative bankers, and what happened to them. Here's a quote. The Republican Party used to specialize in gimlet-eyed, steel-rim, crepe-soled common sense. And then it was taken over by crooked preachers who demanded we trust them because they're packing a Bible and God sent them on a mission to enact lower taxes, less government, except when things crash and then government has to pick up the pieces. That's something Keillor wrote in 2008. So I've always wondered about this. You know, when we had the financial collapse, people looked around, including the Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, and wondered where due stewardship went, where conservative financial policies went with out the door with investment bankers in a free market. And where was that? So I guess my question is, did that Republican Party ever exist, the one of accountants and crepe souls?
Oh, sure. Sure.
It did.
I mean, that's
okay.
Yeah, sure. And I don't think it's – I think it's gone underground because it's very hard to argue with your party when it's winning in great numbers. But you know, take a look at my email. You know, the number of people who have reacted to this book by going, this is my Republican Party and I want it back. How do we get it back? Has just shocked me. Things that I didn't – I mean, 10 years ago, my email ran heavily to hate mail. And this time around, this book is just the opposite. And I do think that one of the things that people are not looking at, again, in the seemingly extraordinary power of the Republican Party right now, again, looking back at the 1880s and the 1890s, the same looked true then. it looked like the party ran for big business and that they had taken over the government and this is the way it was always going to be. It's one of the reasons there was such extraordinary fear of anarchy and of the deaths from striking and from, in the 1920s, the bombings on Wall Street and everything. People were terribly concerned that the government had been completely taken over by big business. But what that does when a party has that kind of control is it does permit there to be reform from within. And in 1884, in 1888, when it looked like the Republican Party had been completely subsumed by wealth, those are the very years that Teddy Roosevelt, Fighting Bob La Follette, Henry Cabot Lodge, and Albert Beveridge were cutting their teeth and saying, we're Republicans through and through, but we cannot live in a society where a very few wealthy men run everything because that's not democracy. That's an oligarchy, and we don't want to live that way. And when they came into power, they changed the entire system back to the way it had been.
We see also Democrats in this age today beholden to Wall Street as well. I mean, we did have the Dodd-Frank Act. Recently, we had a rollback in a key aspect of the Dodd-Frank Act that was meant to reform some of the practices on Wall Street that got us into such trouble. And the President of the United States, a Democrat, and members of Congress went along with some of that, too. So there are people out here, Heather, who say, you scratch their heads and say both parties are beholden to the big money interests.
A pox on both their houses,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I
want to emphasize that people complain that I blame the Republicans for everything. I would point out I also praise them for everything because I study the Republicans. If I studied the Democrats, I would do the exact same thing. I think they have a different trajectory and a different history, and it takes them in a very different place. That being said, yes, you know, when these pendulum swings happen, it's not like the parties continue to stand on the same polls as they did before. Every politician today, every politician, including Barack Obama, whom people call a socialist and a communist and a Muslim and all those things, even Barack Obama is to the right of Dwight Eisenhower. And that, and in Eisenhower's era, he was considered conservative, a reactionary conservative. So, you know, the pendulum does take everybody with it when it swings, but I can speak far more authoritatively about the Republicans than the Democrats, solely because of what I do as a historian.
Right. So tell us about the Tea Party, your views on the Tea Party. Where do they fit into this picture? And have you seen anything like the Tea Party in the past history of the Republican Party?
I have, and I'll maybe touch on that in a minute. But the Tea Party and where the Republican Party is right now is slightly different than the earlier eras for a couple of reasons. But the most important one, and I've gotten flack for this, but I do think it's right, is that the Republican Party always, above everything else, stood for education. It believed that in order for the democracy to be successful, you had to have a very seriously educated population. And while people point to the No Child Left Behind law and to the idea of charter schools, which I actually don't think are about education, I think they're about breaking unions, which is a completely different story. The Republican Party in the present has relied on an undereducated population, which it really has never done before, and quite deliberately done that, I think you can say, because what the Republican Party began to do, first under Reagan, but then under George W. Bush, really it took off, not the father, but the son, is to rely on what they called values voters, people who were voting based on religion, based on sort of an ideological anti-communism, based on the idea that somehow Democrats were evil, were the Antichrist, they had an emotional reaction to voting based on issues and were voting only based on party. And that worked very well. I mean, that's exactly what Grover Norquist said, is that he was going to be able to, and Ralph Reed, is that they were going to be able to deliver the votes that the Republicans needed to put their policies in place. But the problem with that for the party now is that those voters actually expect something in return and have, in fact, become the tail wagging the dog. And that's making it very difficult for the Republicans to continue to attract votes in the what used to be the majority of the party.
It's very interesting that you mentioned education because of a split we see in the GOP field, the likely GOP field of candidates for president in 2016, where Jeb Bush, his potential campaign out there, he supports the Common Core standards that have been put in place. Others in the party, Rand Paul, for one, Marco Rubio, opposing them, saying this is top-down, this is big government, this is federal intrusion. And you see governors in certain states, Republican governors, resisting Common Core standards, again, as a federal intrusion. It's very interesting. You mentioned education in this history of the Republican Party.
Well, and that is a very interesting thing because, of course, Common Core was originally a Republican move. I mean, it was an attempt to standardize what people took in different years of their high school and their lower school years so that it would be easier for corporations to move people around to different states so that your kid was going to have biology in the same year everywhere in America. And initially, there was not a lot of pushback to Common Core. I was actually in on that from the very beginning, watching it and blogging about it. And, you know, if you actually read the standards, which it seems nobody does, they're very generic. But it, again, has become a real football on both sides. It's not just the right that's opposing it, but now it's the left opposing it because it says it's trying to override the teachers' unions. Common Core itself, when it was initially put together, was supported by a large number of Republican governors.
Heather, so I want to ask you this question in the time we have remaining for our conversation today. You know, some people say that this is a period of super partisanship like we've never seen before. We've never seen such harsh or heard such harsh political rhetoric from one side against the other. We've never had a president treated quite this way as Barack Obama has been treated by the right. We've never seen such a harsh split over a social initiative such as the Affordable Care Act. Now, I know we had a civil war, so that was certainly a period of super partisanship. But in modern times here, looking at this with the perspective of a historian, would you say this is a unique period in that regard?
Well, the parallels to reactions to Lincoln are fair, I think. But if you're looking at the modern period, one of the things that people have made a terrible error about is believing that that the two sides can compromise. In fact, moderate Republicans have always compromised. You know, the Susan Collinses of the world or the Nelson Rockefellers or and I'm sure Senator Collins would roll over at hearing her compared to Rockefeller. But the point is that Republicans traditionally just had a different way of looking at the government than the Democrats, but they could work together. What's going on with the modern day Republican Party and the branch that's taken control of it, as I say, since the era of the New Deal, is the belief that the government must do absolutely nothing, and they cannot compromise. Anybody who compromises is, as they say, a rhino, a Republican in name only, which was a term that they developed when George H.W. Bush signed the Omnibus Act, which enabled the government actually to get back into the black under the Clinton administration. The government cannot, if they compromise at all, they read themselves out of the party. And you cannot compromise with somebody who is not willing to give up any ground. It's been a brilliant strategy, and it was a deliberate strategy. It's been a brilliant strategy because it's moved the country farther and farther right as people to the left of those Tea Partiers, if you will, or that Tea Party branch, have tried to compromise. They've managed to move the country dramatically right. But ultimately, you cannot compromise and govern with people who refuse to budge. And so that's what Barack Obama's had to deal with, and I'm not sure anybody really has grappled with the idea these are people who cannot ideologically compromise. And the idea of trying to compromise with people who can't compromise is kind of a dead-end street, and he is unique in having to deal with that. Nobody's had to deal with that before. When it happened to Lincoln, the non-compromisers simply left, and that's not at this point happening. They're staying in the government and moving it their direction.
Heather Cox Richardson is professor of history at Boston College. Her earlier books, Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre, and West from Appomattox, The Reconstruction of America After the Civil War. We're speaking with her today about her book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party, published by Basic Books. Heather, it's been grand having you on the show. Thank you so much for these perspectives. Thank you for your book.
And thank you for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our midday for today. We hope you enjoyed the program. Dan Rodrick's here. We'll be back again tomorrow with another edition of our show, noon to 2 each day here on WYPR, WYPF, WYPO, and streaming online through WYPR.org. For our director, Matt Tackett, thank you for listening and have a great afternoon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.